From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And about an hour ago now, President Trump made it official. He's pulling the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal. The 2015 agreement negotiated by the Obama administration lifted economic sanctions on Iran in exchange for dismantling and inspecting its nuclear weapons program. The president said today all sanctions would be reimposed on Iran.
We will be instituting the highest level of economic sanction. Any nation that helps Iran in its quest for nuclear weapons could also be strongly sanctioned by the United States. America will not be held hostage to nuclear blackmail.
Barbara Slavin is director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. She joins us from Washington. Barbara, your first reaction.
Well, what can I say? It's what we had, most of us had anticipated. Some thought there might be a little bit of wiggle room that he would call for more negotiations with the Europeans, but he has now shot through the eyes what was essentially a zombie agreement for the last 15 months. I mean, we've known that President Trump wanted to withdraw from this deal from the very beginning, and he has now done it completely and decisively. But what he has not done is explained exactly what is going to be put in its place and how he intends to constrain Iran's quote-unquote nuclear ambitions.
Well, this seems to be the biggest criticism, that if the concern of many who backed Donald Trump's thinking about the deal was that built into the deal was that some of the requirements about the nuclear program would go away in 10 or so, 15 or so years, why make them possibly all go away now? Are you concerned that Iran might react by building up its nuclear capabilities, or do you think Iran and the remaining signatories to the deal, Germany, France, China, Russia, Britain, do you think that they can go it alone?
Well, that is the ultimate question. I think the Europeans are certainly going to try to convince the Iranians to stay in the deal. The Russians and the Chinese will do the same. But the question is, are all these other parties willing to defy the United States and defy American sanctions in order to do so? I think Russia and China clearly will, perhaps Turkey will. I don't know about the Europeans. You know, the European governments may protest, but will their companies really be willing to risk their business in the United States in order to do business with Iran? Mm-hmm. I have my doubts. So I think this is a devastating blow. I think Trump has absolutely killed this agreement. And as I mentioned before, there is nothing to put in its place, and he is not capable of negotiating anything to put in his place. He talked about negotiating with American allies about a replacement. He has to talk to the Iranian government, and the only language he's used with the Iranian government is one of insult and threat. So I think this is a very, very sad day for American foreign policy and a very sad day for American leadership in the world.
Well, what does happen now? Because there was some there was a lot of speculation as to how this might go. For instance, you talk about what other countries might do. The president might say, we're going to impose sanctions again on American companies like Boeing. They can no longer sell planes. But does that also mean that France, the Airbus, can't sell planes to Iran if the U.S. imposes a sanction?
Yes, well, Airbus planes have more than 10% U.S. content. I believe they have General Electric engines. So Airbus will not be able to sell planes. Boeing has already put off delivery of planes in anticipation of this decision. When I say this was a zombie agreement, President Trump has put so much uncertainty over it since he came into office that many companies, major companies that had planned on doing business with Iran, have already withdrawn. So Iran now will collect itself. It will find other ways to try to sell its oil. It will find other ways to try to survive. But it's a very proud country. Whatever you may think about its policies in the Middle East or the way it treats its own people, it's going to be very difficult for me to envision Iran sitting down with this administration or indeed a future American administration. After all, it's the United States which has cheated on this agreement, not Iran.
Well, and of course, the president cited information that was delivered in that sort of PowerPoint presentation from Prime Minister Netanyahu as proof that it was Iran that had cheated. But every analyst said that Netanyahu had nothing but some things that had happened before 2003. And no, the overwhelming thinking of analysts and inspectors is that Iran had stuck with the deal.
Absolutely. What Netanyahu did was present a, warmed over old news. This was information that related to Iran's past nuclear activities. Yes, Iran had a nuclear weapons program in the past, but it never built any nuclear weapons. And this agreement, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, provided insurance that Iran could not build nuclear weapons for a decade or more. Now that insurance is gone.
Yeah, look, we've spoken to other voices. Reuel Marc Gerecht is one, somebody who's long been critical of the deal. He says that it doesn't address Iran's use of its missile capability or its backing of terrorist groups, Hamas, Hezbollah, in his view, in the region. Is there anything here that tells you that those things can now be addressed?
No, really. The idea was that the nuclear deal would be the foundation for discussions with Iran on other issues. Instead, what the Trump administration has done is, as I mentioned, cast uncertainty over this agreement. It has squandered its opportunity to use the channels established by the agreement to talk to Iran about these other issues. There is no reason that Iran is now going to come to the table to talk about these issues with the United States. And I think we may see Iranian influence in the region simply grow bigger. Than it already is.
Barbara Slavin of the Atlantic Council, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, West Virginians are voting in a key Senate primary today. The three main Republican candidates want a chance to challenge Democratic Senator Joe Manchin in November. President Trump has weighed in, urging voters to reject one of the candidates, Don Blankenship. The president tweeted that Blankenship can't win in the general election. Joining us now is Dave Mistich, who's a reporter with West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Dave, there's Attorney General Patrick Morrissey, Congressman Evan Jenkins, and Don Blankenship, the former mining executive who served time in prison after a 2010 explosion at one of his coal mines killed 29 people. This is shaping up to be a very close race.
Absolutely, yes. All eyes have been on this seat for U.S. Senator Joe Manchin's seat for quite some time. But things have gotten increasingly more interesting as time has rolled along. The candidates in this race have sort of failed to go after Don Blankenship for his past. But, all that changed over the past week. And of course, with the president weighing in, the dynamic changed even more.
So Blankenship has run some ads that have raised some eyebrows and have been widely criticized. Let's listen to one.
Swamp Captain Mitch McConnell has created millions of jobs for China people. While doing so, Mitch has gotten rich. In fact, his China family has given him tens of millions of dollars.
His China family, his wife is of Chinese descent. He also refers to cocaine Mitch McConnell. What is he talking about there?
Well, it's kind of a stretch to get there. So, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, of course, referring to his wife, U.S. Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao. Her father owns a shipping company that was once implicated, however, never charged, one of their ships being caught with cocaine on it. This is years ago. But this is sort of the line that, Mr. Blankenship's drawing to attack Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. His would-be opponent in November, if Manchin wins his primary today as well, would be, the sitting senator. So it's kind of funny to us that he's been attacking someone that really isn't a part of this race necessarily. However, he's just sort of attacking what he calls the establishment politicians that he claims have been attacking him all throughout this race.
And does that play well in West Virginia?
Well, I think we're about to see. I think that the racially charged words that are used there make a lot of people uncomfortable. I think Mr. Blankenship's been tremendously defiant throughout this entire race. He's self-funded his campaign. It's been a sort of mixed reaction to him in a lot of ways. And I think with all the increased attention that more people across the state and especially more people across the country have become familiar with him as a personality, in politics, in this race, as well as long before, that he's played a role.
Well, let's talk about the other candidates. Patrick Morrissey is the attorney general there. Here's an ad from his campaign.
Patrick Morrissey, NRA A-plus rating, endorsed by gun groups, endorsed by West Virginians for life, pro-life, pro-gun, pro-coal, pro-Trump.
Pro-Trump. Let's listen to an ad from Evan Jenkins' campaign.
And Jenkins helped start Lily's Place, caring for newborns exposed to drugs.
Evan Jenkins helped get Lily's Place started. The Trump administration wanting to shine light on the work of the facility.
Working with Trump, West Virginia values Evan Jenkins.
So everybody's saying that they are allied with Trump. Now, if Blankenship wins the primary, could he beat Joe Manchin?
You know, I think that there's a lot of questions. I think Manchin's got, he's more or less a stalwart here in West Virginia. He's been in politics for more than 30 years. He was the governor, you know, Secretary of State, state senator. He's been around in politics for such a long time. It seems unimaginable, but with Blankenship having this sort of this vendetta against Manchin, it's not unreasonable to believe that he would throw every dollar he could at a campaign against Manchin.
And could Manchin win against the other candidates?
You know, there's a lot of polling out there that suggests that he's vulnerable. But again, you know, it's very difficult to tell at this point. You know, I spoke to Senator Manchin a few weeks back, and he said that, you know, he doesn't pick his opponents. He doesn't choose for them to run against him. But, you know, he seems confident that he'll be ready, you know, after today and going into November.
That's Dave Misich, a senior reporter with West Virginia Public Broadcasting. We'll be watching the results tonight. Dave, thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Leonia, New Jersey is not far from the George Washington Bridge linking New Jersey with Manhattan. And when the traffic app Waze became popular, Leonia's streets were jam-packed with cars diverted from the highways. So Leonia has banned non-resident drivers from all but its main roads during the morning and evening rush hours 7 days a week. The New Jersey Attorney General says the ordinance isn't legal, but Leonia Mayor Judah Ziegler says he's keeping it. Mayor Ziegler joins us by Skype. Mayor, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy, for having me.
Well, and first, just give us a sense of the traffic problems that existed in Leonia that led the town to adopt this Safe Streets program.
So Leonia is in a very interesting spot geographically. We're at the confluence of three major highways, and we're about a half mile from the world's busiest bridge, the George Washington Bridge. And so every day during the morning and evening key drive periods, we were seeing about 4,000 vehicles enter our municipality and go on our main road seeking an alternate route to the George Washington Bridge. Hmm. When there's a tie-up at the bridge, what we found was that number increased to 12,000 vehicles.
Wow.
And with the adoption, broad adoption of these navigational apps, those apps were directing all of those vehicles onto our extremely narrow residential side streets. And that's where the problems were occurring. Drivers are distracted. They're looking at their apps, trying to figure out where they are. They're not looking out their windshields. We had, over the past few years, a very sharp increase in the number of pedestrian motor vehicle incidents. Hmm. And so we've appealed to the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey to assist us. They run the George Washington Bridge. We've gotten no help from them. We've gotten no help from the state. We've gotten no help from the county. We've gotten no help from anybody.
So you took matters into your own hands and said, we're going to adopt this Safe Streets program. So what exactly does it do? How does it work?
So the program is very, very simple. We have three main roads in our municipality, in addition to the residential side streets that I referenced previously. Except for those three roads, during the key drive periods, morning and evening, 7 days a week, our roads are restricted to residents and those with a destination in Leonia, be it a business or a residence.
How do you enforce that, by the way?
So before we started enforcement, we issued hang tags to all of our residents, as well as to employees of businesses in the municipality, employees of the school district, et cetera. And then it's really education. So again, the goal here was not to increase revenue. In fact, we started enforcement on January 22nd. From then till now, we have not issued a single citation.
Hmm.
The goal here was to address the technology, and we've been working with Waze and Google Maps and others for a while. And the only way that they could remove our streets from their algorithms is if our streets were shown as restricted access streets.
Hmm.
So literally, the minute before the morning or evening time goes into effect, the streets are clear in the navigational apps. And then when it clicks over to the top of the hour, those streets are removed from the algorithms. We're not saying don't come into Leonia. We just need to keep that traffic on our main streets because those are the streets that are designed to accommodate that level of traffic.
And even though you haven't issued a single citation, you're saying the traffic problems have gone away.
Absolutely. I mean, if you listen, traffic problems. And again, we want to be sure that people understand. We are a municipality that exists 20 minutes from Midtown Manhattan.
Right.
We're going to have a lot of traffic. Anybody who doesn't want traffic in their town shouldn't live in a town in Bergen County, New Jersey. So this isn't about reducing traffic. It's about redirecting commuter traffic to where it belongs, either staying on the highway or on one of our main streets. And that's exactly what this has done.
Now, there is a lawsuit that's been filed by a resident of Edgewater, which is a neighboring area. And she says she wants to be able to come in. She's not a commuter. She wants to be able to come in to go to the businesses there. What's been your response to that?
So I can't comment, obviously, on the specifics of pending litigation. However, as I said previously, the ordinance is very, very clear. The restrictions apply to residents and Leonia destinations only. So if you are coming to a destination Leonia, residential, business, etc., you may use any street at any time without restriction. In addition, all of the businesses in our municipality exist on one of the three main streets that I referenced earlier that are exempted from these restrictions. So if the plaintiff in the suit, if her concern is that she can't visit a business in the municipality, she's wrong.
Have you had mayors from other places around the country call you up and ask you about how this worked, and do they want to copy what you've done?
So I've had a few inquiries from elected officials in other areas of the country. There is another municipality in New Jersey, the township of Weehawken, which immediately borders the Lincoln Tunnel, another main Hudson River crossing, that has enacted similar legislation. And somebody asked me a while ago, do you think that a lot of municipalities are going to do this? And my answer is, I hope not, because we didn't do this to try to reduce traffic. And it shouldn't be used as a way to reduce traffic. We needed to redirect this commuter traffic to where it belongs. There are drive times that occur when children are walking to school, when adults are walking to the bus stop to take the bus to work. It was going to be a matter of if not when someone was going to be seriously injured or, God forbid, killed by a distracted commuter. This is a matter of public safety.
Do you ever use Waze?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I travel for business. I use Waze. I think it's a great app. And by the way, I want to say, as I've said many times, Waze, Google Maps, and the navigational folks have been very, very supportive of this. When we first enacted the legislation in December, Waze came out publicly with a statement of support and applauded us for being proactive on this issue.
That's Judah Ziegler, who is the mayor of Leonia, New Jersey. We'll link you to more about what they are up to with their traffic at hereandnow.org. Mayor Ziegler, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And just across the Hudson River in Manhattan, the Whitney Museum of American Art has put about 100 works of the artist Zoe Leonard on display. Her photographs have been shown in major institutions around the world, but Leonard has never had a career retrospective in an American museum until now. The 56-year-old American has taken on the issues of AIDS, immigration, feminism, gender, and the presidency. The show is called Survey, and Karen Michelle has this artist profile.
Leonard is best known as a photographer and takes many images of a single subject, and those often become series. A student of photography history, Leonard is no acolyte of Ansel Adams' super sharp focus or Cartier-Bresson's decisive moment.
I was never able to get that shot. Like, I think as a young photographer, I've tried for that and I was miserably unsuccessful. But I realized that the way that I work is more faithful to how I actually experience the world. It's not a series of perfect, isolated, dramatic moments where life is writ large. It's a kind of ongoing set of movements and experiences and relationship that reveal nuance over time and through repetition.
Leonard takes photographs of storefronts, tree stumps in the city, and views through an airplane window, and assembles groups of ordinary things, books, old postcards. She knows that her life's work can, like the artist, seem deceptively unassuming.
It pays attention to things that are taken for granted in our everyday life. A lot of the pictures are kind of have a humbleness to them.
The act of making art has always been taking the humble things of the earth, the humble things of our world, and bestowing them with a life and with a meaning.
Adam Weinberg is the director of the Whitney Museum.
That is what great artists do, whether it's Michelangelo cutting out of stone or whether it's Zoe Leonard taking the skins of fruit.
Weinberg means that literally. In the exhibition, one room is devoted to an installation made of rotting produce, oranges, bananas, grapefruit, and avocado. Their peels are strewn across the floor. The title of the piece is Strange Fruit, named after the Billie Holiday song.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves. murdered at the root.
It refers to lynching. So it's the connection between the destruction of life, whether it's by people or by disease, and the fragility, and then the ability and the desire to try to overcome that and persist in spite of disease, in spite of hatred, in spite of disregard and lack of caring on the part of one individual to another.
Many of the fruits are crudely stitched back together or zippered or have buttons on their sides. It's intended as a reflection on AIDS. Strange Fruit was created in 1992 in the wake of the epidemic that swept the world. That's the same year that Leonard created another work called I Want a President, a typed statement that begins, I want a dyke for a president, and concludes with not wanting a president who is, quote, always a boss and never a worker, always a liar, always a thief, and never caught, unquote. Today, Leonard doesn't want to dwell on that piece, but says she is honored her work remains relevant.
I think all of the work is inflected with a kind of interest in what it means to be a citizen, what it means to be a human being, what it means to live a life. And for me, those things are political. I don't see them as separate things.
Some of the work is intensely personal. One sculpture is a row of used blue suitcases, the kind you see in thrift shops, one for every year of Leonard's life.
You carry your suitcase through the very most public places, but inside it you have your most private belongings. So it's a kind of an analog for a body, and it's a self-portrait. That's what it is.
When the exhibition moves to the Los Angeles Museum of Contemporary Art, which instigated the survey, Zoe Leonard will be a year older and add another suitcase.
To simplify the shipping, they wanted to get the next year's suitcase now. And that felt like hubris to me. I was like, no, I'm sorry. I'll send it to LA after next September.
When she turns 57. So the show isn't really as much a retrospective as a prospective. For NPR News, I'm Karen Michelle.
We're following the news today that President Trump is pulling the U.S. out of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. It's a deal that put restrictions on that country's nuclear program and in exchange lifted sanctions, including on Iran's oil exports. So today's change has big implications for oil markets around the world. And joining us with more on that is Uri Berliner, NPR senior business editor. Hi, Uri.
Hey, Jeremy.
And what does leaving the deal mean for oil prices?
Well, the first thing to keep in mind is that oil prices have been going up for months now. And one of the big reasons for that is just that supplies are tighter. There's not as much of a glut on the market. So if these sanctions mean that Iran doesn't get to export as much oil and that limits supplies, it could push prices even higher.
Well, you mentioned oil prices have been going up. They were up over $70 a barrel yesterday and early today. That's the first time that's happened since 2014. Then they took a plunge this morning as news was coming out about what President Trump was going to do. But then after the president announced that he's leaving the deal, the prices spiked back up again, nearly $70 a barrel. Why would that happen?
Well, I mean, you never know exactly what traders are thinking, but it may have been that, you know, they were hoping that maybe the full force of sanctions wouldn't be imposed. But President Trump today said that he would impose the highest level of economic sanctions. So there's no breathing room there. So maybe that's why the oil prices started going back up.
Now, Iran is OPEC's third largest oil producer and currently produces about 3.8 million barrels of oil per day. That's according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. How significant is that for global supply?
Well, it's significant. I mean, Iran produces about 5% of world output. You know, on the margins, it's important, but especially now because, as I said, supplies are tighter. This glut of oil is being absorbed. There's global economy is growing. People are spending more money. They're traveling more. Factories are producing more. So there's more demand for energy. So the oil that Iran produces, the extent to which that's taken off the market, that could affect prices.
And are there other factors here as well? We've been hearing over the last several years that U.S. production is up. So that's been keeping prices down. What else has been driving the prices up other than Iran?
Yeah, well, I mean, several years ago, just everybody was pumping as much oil as possible, including U.S. Shale oil producers, and that was pushing prices way down. They went down to as low as $27 a barrel back in 2016. But then this very notable thing happened. At the end of 2016, Russia and Saudi Arabia and a number of other countries, they agreed to cut production, to limit the amount they produce to push up prices. And those kinds of agreements usually fall apart because one member or more starts cheating. They just keep selling oil into the market because they need the cash. But this time it actually worked. And it was really relevant because Russia and Saudi Arabia are two of the largest oil producers.
Now, as we're watching the oil markets, we're also watching the stock market, which has been up and down today, but it's basically flat. It hasn't moved all that much. What does that tell you?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like the stock market is pretty chill about this. It didn't react much. It's possible that, you know, they had just priced this in already. They assumed that President Trump would pull out of the nuclear deal. He's been saying that he, you know, would do that for quite a long time. Right. So maybe they just weren't surprised.
Baked into the cake. Uri Berliner, NPR Senior Business Editor. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
China's top economic advisor will be in Washington next week for a new round of negotiations meant to head off a trade war with the United States. In March, the Trump administration imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, a move that remains contentious among economists in the U.S. Yesterday, we heard from one economist who says tariffs can protect American workers. Today, another viewpoint. Ellen Hughes Cromwick was chief economist at the Department of Commerce under President Obama. She's now with the University of Michigan's Energy Institute. Ellen, welcome, and start by telling us why you think these new tariffs are a bad idea.
Well, first, let me say how much I feel for any workers who are displaced by shifts in domestic and global economic trends. Clearly, you know, one of the things we know, especially here in the Midwest, is how difficult, you know, these transitions can be for people and industries. It's a complicated issue, Jeremy, but trade tariffs historically have not achieved the desired results. If we look, for example, back at the Bush administration years, you may know that they really tried to address the steel market imbalances mm-hmm. by slapping on a large tariff, 30%. And what happened within a matter of months, they took the tariffs off. And one of the reasons is because we end up hurting other industries who use steel because steel prices, in that case, rose by as much as an estimated 40%. And then we lost jobs in those sectors that were using steel. The point I really want to make is it sounds good that you're really helping a particular industry who may be suffering from intense competition from mm-hmm. abroad. However, you're not really helping. You're actually hurting the overall economy and all workers.
Well, but what you said at the beginning about how you understand the pain that people
yes.
in the Midwest have felt, do you think that that pain was because of free trade?
I think the pain is partly because of the way that our market economy works. To be honest, we know in many of the professions around economics and other social sciences, we know how to ease the transition and ease the pain associated with trade flows. And, you know, you may be aware we have a trade adjustment assistance program, but it represents about 0.1% of the size of our economy. We are almost dead last in terms of the kind of support we provide workers when their industry is changing. One of the reasons that China started producing a lot of steel wasn't just to export, it was that they were in their sweet spot of growth, much as we were right after World War II. And consequently, you know, they said, well, we got to produce steel here because we're building out infrastructure. We're building a lot of cities. Now, I'm not suggesting that there aren't episodes of unfair trade practices. And thankfully, that's why we have Section 301 of the Trade Act, which addresses unfair trade practices around dumping product in countries like the U.S., dumping it here at below cost. Absolutely. However, the results from implementing that anti-dumping are really mixed, and there are better ways to address that transition and to be proactive.
So yesterday we heard from Rob Scott, an economist with the Economic Policy Institute, and he said that fears of a trade war are uninformed scaremongering. He said China is much more dependent on the American market than the U.S. is on China. What do you think of that? Is he underselling the risk of a trade war with China?
You know, I guess I wouldn't project with any great degree of certainty how this is going to play out. We need to be thinking creatively and proactively about what are the policies that we can put in place that stimulate investment for the future growth, that help workers transition to other industries, you know, give them the kind of support that they deserve and need. That, I think, is where the focus should be in terms of policy.
Do you think there are any circumstances in which tariffs can be productive?
I think that they can potentially send signals that we are watching what is happening should there be dumping of product. We are there. We're going to support industries. However, we got to look at the reality of, you know, what the results are. And the results, they just don't get us to a point where we're going to, you know, pick winners in terms of industries. I mean, that's one of the reasons our market system overall works very well and why we've enjoyed significant economic growth and prosperity in this country is because we do let the market system send signals about where to invest and where to grow.
Now, we're talking tariffs in this case of 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum. Some would say not a huge hike. Advocates of these tariffs say any cost increase for consumers would be very small. We remember when the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, went on TV and said, you know, this is only going to raise the price of a can of Campbell's soup by 0.6%. Do you think that opponents of tariffs are overselling the economic impact downstream?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, Jeremy. Exactly what you said. Plus, add to that, they're going to exempt several countries.
Right.
For which, you know, who are really major trading partners. And, oh, by the way, they're also allies of the United States. And then you kind of ask yourself the question, well, then what is the point? Why pursue this so aggressively and spend, by the way, spend all the money around pursuing it when we could be approaching other areas of policy that we know have long-lasting effects? We know, for example, if you do trade adjustment assistance properly and you put a force of a budget behind it, that will help people transition to industries that are growing. We know that if we did support education and major infrastructure programs, we know those are job creators. And also we have, for example, in the U.S., a program called Select USA, which is all about matching up foreign companies' potential investment in the U.S., and that investment helps grow jobs. So there's a lot of things we know how to do, and we know they are proven results for growing this economy and growing jobs here.
This is a very interesting issue right now because politically it's changing who's behind it, who's not behind it. You would think that this would be a situation where Democrats were saying, let's have these tariffs, and Republicans would say, let's have free trade. In this case, it's the Trump administration, the Republicans, that are pushing it. Who do you think is your ally in this fight more at this point?
Well, as an economist, I'm looking at the data, and I'm trying to assess what the data show There's no political version of what I'm trying to propose. What I'm trying to say is we have data and we have studies and research that show how we can make our economy grow and prosper for our people. And we know that the economy is very dynamic. Look at what we're living in, one of the most unique periods in economic history with substantial technology advancements and a lot of disruption. And we know the kinds of policies that work to incentivize investment in new technology. Look at the great advances that we've made in many different areas now in electrified vehicles. That's the kind of growth that we, in proactive nature, we have to be looking ahead to and investing in.
That's Ellen Hughes Cromwick, who is a former chief economist at the Department of Commerce. She's now at the University of Michigan's Energy Institute. Great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
And you can find our conversation with economist Rob Scott, who supports the tariffs, at hereandnow.org.
Autism often struggle to find work. The unemployment rate for autistic adults soars above the national average, even though the majority don't have impaired intelligence. But a new program in California's Bay Area is pioneering ways to turn perceived disabilities into strengths. Peter Arcuni from member station KQED reports.
20-year-old Ryan Karstner is surrounded by rocks, thousands of them, overflowing from boxes and cabinets in a cramped storeroom here at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park.
Like sedimentary, really deep type stuff, and then ones that are more close to the surface.
The rocks range from rust-hued sandstone to smooth gray basalt. Some have been collecting dust in rooms like this for more than 50 years, until now.
The best way I can describe it is that I take the rock, I look at what the date is. This one, it says WRA64.8. I type the numbers up into the spreadsheet, and then I put the rock inside the bag.
This cataloging will help geologists make maps, the type of maps that locate hazards, like fault lines. The work is mostly data entry and might not seem glamorous, but for Ryan, who was diagnosed with autism at age 5, this is a big deal.
I like rocks a lot, and to know that I'm assisting in building maps that could help people, it's kind of like, wow.
Public schools are required by law to offer job training for students with disabilities. But in reality, there aren't many choices, and programs are generally underfunded. Ryan's mom, Janine, says she and Ryan's father wondered where to turn for help.
Your options a lot of times are limited. It's a struggle.
A lot of the programs that are out there prepare students for simple tasks, like folding laundry or bagging groceries. Ryan's dad, Richard, says his son can bring a lot more to a workplace.
There's got to be other programs out there other than, hey, just go wash dishes, right? Something that could possibly become a career, something that could fuel his interest.
Ryan's passion? Anything to do with the outdoors. So earlier this year, when the Karstners learned about training opportunities at the Geological Survey, the family jumped at the chance. Ryan's dad still remembers the first day his son came home.
He walks in the door, he's got a smile ear to ear, and he goes, "You'll never believe what happened. I got to hold a piece of a fault line. And it's 6 million years old. How awesome is that?" And I was like, this is going to be a great place.
Ryan is one of 12 students from 3 Bay Area school districts participating in a program called Step Up. Students volunteer at USGS a few times a week and receive a stipend from the state. While it's just getting off the ground in California, the program was pioneered at the survey's Virginia office in 2012. It proved so beneficial to students and scientists, the agency decided to expand it. Which brings us to the story of Kevin Kim, whose managers speak of him with reverence.
He's become legendary.
That's Chris Hammond, who coordinates the Step Up program. Kevin struggles with speech, but was brilliant in a project studying bird migration.
Well, I did the bird banding and also found some emails and
Bird banding is when researchers put little bracelets on the legs of birds. On those bracelets is an email address, so the public can help with tracking. It was Kevin's job to go through a huge backlog of emails and extract the relevant data.
Kevin, in record time, cleared it out. He was so fast, the firewall suspected him of being a bot.
But it wasn't just his speed. It was also his accuracy. Hammond says the error rate of most people USGS hires for this type of work is around 3%. The step-up cohort in Virginia averages 0.3%.
I didn't know much about autism before I got involved with this group, but what I'm finding is these students are tuned to very fine, unique, and wonderful wavelengths. And when you get them on that wavelength, they are just incredible.
When Kevin turned 22, he aged out of Step Up and many of the services offered to people with autism. But USGS hired Kevin part-time, along with three other students. He's now a co-author on a published study. It's a point of pride for Kevin.
It makes me feel good, yeah.
Journalist Steve Silberman got to know hundreds of young people with autism for his book Neurotribes. He says each one is passionate about something.
Whether it's Pokemon or Disney movies.
Computer games or collecting rocks. And these interests can seem like obsessions.
It turns out that the obsessions, or if you will, passionate interests of autistic people, often provide the basis for a career or a pathway forward.
Traits associated with autistic people, like hyperfocus and repetitive behavior, can translate into them becoming hardworking, detail-oriented employees.
And so by supporting those interests, you actually give the person the best chance of success.
That's what programs like Step Up are trying to do. Without the chance to put their abilities to use, autistic kids can find it difficult to transition to adulthood. Suicide is a serious problem for autistic adults, says Silberman.
So we're not just talking about making people's lives more fun or something. We're actually talking about issues of life and death.
Ryan Karsner's mentor at USGS says he hopes he'll be able to keep him on to finish the rock archival project and maybe even get him into the field to collect samples. Ryan says the experience has him rethinking what's possible.
Realizing that I can be somebody that I want to be instead of just everybody telling me that I'm going to be something I don't want to.
Just being himself and making his abilities work for him. That's how he's going to find his way forward. For Here and Now, I'm Peter Arcudi.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.